Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Some things you wouldn't mind being stuck with, like a huge inheritance. But a phone that has to be plugged in just right so it charges is not one of those things. Switch to Verizon and we'll pay off your old phone up to $800 via prepaid MasterCard for a new one on us. Just trade in any phone from our top brands with select unlimited plans.
$829.99 purchase with new smartphone line on select unlimited plans. Minimum $90 per month with auto pay plus taxes and fees for 36 months required. Plus $830 trade-in slash promo credit applied over 36 months. Trade-in terms apply. Payoff phone requires smartphone purchase and port-in with new smartphone line on select plan. Must provide most recent bill showing payoff amount of eligible phone. Additional terms apply.
Book 3, Chapter 5 of 10 Books on Architecture. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Fredrik Karlsson. 10 Books on Architecture by Vitruvius. Translated by Morris Hickey Morgan. Chapter 5. Proportions of the base, capitals, and entablature in the Ionic order. 1. This finished, let the bases of the columns be set in place and constructed in such proportions that their height, including the plinth, may be half the thickness of a column, and their projection, called in Greek ekphora, the same. Thus in both length and breadth it will be 1 1/2 thicknesses of a column. 2. If the base is to be in the Attic style, let its height be so divided that the upper part shall be 1 part of the thickness of the column and the rest left for the plinth. Then, excluding the plinth, let the rest be divided into 4 parts, and of these let 1/4 constitute the upper torus, and let the other 3 be divided equally, 1 part composing the lower torus, and the other, with its fillets, the scotia, which the Greeks call trochlos. 3. But if Ionic plates are to be built, their proportions shall be so determined that the base may be each way equal in breadth to the thickness of a column plus 3/8 of the thickness, its height that of the Attic base, and so too its plinth. Excluding the plinth, let the rest, which will be the 3rd part of the thickness of a column, be divided into 7 parts. 3 of these parts constitute the torus at the top, and the other 4 are to be divided equally, 1 part constituting the upper trochilus, with its astragals and overhang, the other left for the lower trochilus, but the lower will seem to be larger because it will project to the edge of the plinth. The astragals must be 1/8 of the trochilus. The projection of the base will be 3/16 of the thickness of a column. 4. The bases being thus finished and put in place, the columns are to be put in place. The middle columns are the front and rear porticos perpendicular to their own center. The corner columns and those which are to extend in a line from them along the sides of the temple to the right and left are to be set so that their inner sides, which face towards the cella wall, are perpendicular, but their outer sides in the manner which I have described in speaking of their diminution. Thus, in the design of the temple, the lines will be adjusted with due regard to the diminution. 5. The shafts of the column having been erected, the rule for the capitals will be as follows. If they are to be cushion-shaped, they should be so proportioned that the abacus is in the length and breadth equivalent to the thickness of the shaft at its bottom plus 1/18 thereof, and the height of the capital, including the volutes, 1/2 of that amount. The faces of the volutes must recede from the edge of the abacus inwards by 1 1/18 of the same amount. Then, the height of the capital is to be divided into 9 1/2 parts, and down along the abacus on the 4 sides of the volutes, down along the fillet at the edge of the abacus, lines called catheti are to be let fall. Then, of the 9 1/2 part, let 1 1/2 be reserved for the height of the abacus, and let the other 8 be used for the volutes. 6. Then let another line be drawn, beginning at the point situated at a distance of 1 1/2 parts toward the inside from the line previously let fall down along the edge of the abacus. Next, let these lines be divided in such a way as to leave 4 1/2 parts under the abacus. Then, at the point which forms the division between 4.5 parts and the remaining 3.5, fix the center of the eye, and from that center describe a circle with a diameter equal to 1/8 parts. This will be the size of the eye, and in it draw a diameter on the line of the catheters. Then, in describing the quadrants, let the size of each be successively less by 1/2 the diameter of the eye than that which begins under the abacus and proceed from the eye until the same quadrant under the abacus is reached. 7. The height of the capital is to be such that of the 9.5 parts, 3 parts are below the level of the astragal at the top of the shaft, and the rest, omitting the abacus and the channel, belongs to its echinus. The projection of the echinus beyond the fillet of the abacus should be equal to the size of the eye. The projection of the bands of the cushions should be thus obtained. Place one leg of a pair of compasses in the center of the capital and open out the other to the edge of the echinus. Bring this leg around and it will touch the outer edge of the bands. The axis of the volutes should not be thicker than the size of the eye, and the volutes themselves should be channeled out to a depth which is 1/12 of their height. These will be the symmetrical proportions for capitals of columns 25 feet high and less. For higher columns, the other proportions will be the same, but the length and breadth of the abacus will be the thickness of the lower diameter of a column plus 1/9 part thereof. Thus, just as the higher the column the less the diminution, so the projection of its capital is proportionately increased and its breadth is correspondingly enlarged. 8. With regard to the method of describing volutes, at the end of the book a figure will be subjoined, and a calculation showing how they may be described so that their spirals may be true to the compass. The capitals having been finished and set up in due proportion to the columns, not exactly level on the columns, however, but with the same measured adjustment, so that in the upper members there may be an increase corresponding to that which was made in the stylobates. The rule for the architraves is to be as follows. If the columns are at least 12 feet and not more than 15 feet high, let the height of the architrave be equal to 1/2 the thickness of a column at the bottom. If they are from 15 feet to 20, let the height of a column be measured off in 13 parts and let one of these be the height of the architrave. If they are from 20 to 25 feet, let this height be divided into 12.5 part, and let one of them form the height of the architrave. If they are from 25 feet to 30, let it be divided into 12 parts, and let one of them form the height. If they are higher, the heights of the architraves are to be worked out proportionately in the same manner from the height of the columns. 9. For the higher that the eye has to climb, the less easily can it make its way through the thicker and thicker mass of air. So it fails when the height is great, its strength is sucked out of it, and it conveys to the mind only a confused estimate of the dimensions. Hence, there must always be a corresponding increase in the symmetrical proportions of the members, so that whether the buildings are on unusually lofty sides or are themselves somewhat colossal, the size of the parts may seem in due proportion. The depth of the architrave on its underside just above the capital is to be equivalent to the thickness of the top of the column just under the capital, and on its uppermost side equivalent to the foot of the shaft. 10. The cymatium of the architrave should be 1/7 of the height of the whole architrave, and its projection the same. Omitting the cymatium, the rest of the architrave is to be divided into 12 parts, and 3 of these will form the lowest fascia, 4 the next, and 5 the highest fascia. The frieze above the architrave is 1/4 less high than the architrave, but if there are to be reliefs upon it, it is 1/4 higher than the architrave, so that the sculptures may be more imposing. Its cymatium is 1/7 of the whole height of the frieze, and the projection of the cymatium is the same as its height. 11. Over the frieze comes the line of dentils, made of the same height as the middle fascia of the architrave, and with a projection equal to their height. The intersection, or in Greek metope, is apportioned so that the face of each dental is 1/2 as wide as its height, and the cavity of each intersection 2/3 of this face in width. The cymatium here is 1/6 of the whole height of this part. The corona with its cymatium, but not including the cyma, has the height of the middle fascia of the architrave, and the total projection of the corona and dentils should be equal to the height from the frieze to the cymatium at the top of the corona. And, as a general rule, all projecting parts have greater beauty when their projection is equal to their height. 12. The height of the tympanum, which is in the pediment, is to be obtained thus. Let the front of the corona, from the two ends of its cymatium, be measured off into 9 parts, and let one of these parts be set up in the middle at the peak of the tympanum, taking care that it is perpendicular to the entablature and the neckings of the columns. The coronae over the tympanum are to be made of equal size with the coronae under it, not including the cymae. Above the coronae are the cymae, in the Greek epitides, which should be made 1/8 higher than the height of the coronae. The acroteria at the corners have the height of the center of the tympanum, and thus in the middle are 1/8 part higher than those at the corners. 13. All the members which are to be above the capitals of the columns, that is, architraves, friezes, coronae, tympana, gables, and acroteria, should be inclined to the front a 1/12 part of their own height, for the reason that when we stand in front of them, if 2 lines are drawn from the eye, one reaching to the bottom of the building and the other to the top, that which reaches to the top will be longer. Hence, as the line of sight to the upper part is the longer, it makes that part look as if it were leaning back. But when the members are inclined to the front, as described above, they will seem to the beholder to be plumb and perpendicular. 14. Each column should have 24 flutes, channeled out in such a way that if a carpenter's square be placed in the hollow of a flute and turned, the arm will touch the corners of the fillets on the right and left, and the tip of the square may keep touching some point in the concave surface as it moves through it. The breadth of the flutes is to be equivalent to the enlargement in the middle of a column, which will be found in the figure. 15. In the cymae, which are over the coronae on the sides of the temple, lions' heads are to be carved and arranged at intervals thus. First, one head is marked out directly over the axis of each column, and then the others are arranged at equal distances apart, and so that there shall be one at the middle of every roof tiling. Those that are over the columns should have holes bored through them to the gutter, which receives the rainwater from the tiles, but those between them should be solid. Thus, the mass of water that falls by way of the tiles into the gutter will not be thrown down along the intercolumniation, nor drench people who are passing through them, while the lions' heads that are over the columns will appear to be vomiting as they discharge streams of water from their mouths. In this book I have written as clearly as I could on the arrangements of the Ionic temples. In the next I shall explain the proportions of Doric and Corinthian temples. End of Book 3. Book 4, Introduction and Chapters 1 and 2 of 10 Books on Architecture. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Fredrik Karlsson. 10 Books on Architecture by Vitruvius. Translated by Morris Hickey Morgan. Book 4. Introduction. 1. I have observed, Emperor, that many in their treatises and volumes of commentaries on architecture have not presented the subject with well-ordered completeness, but have merely made a beginning and left, as it were, only desultory fragments. I have therefore thought that it would be a worthy and very useful thing to reduce the whole of this great art to a complete and orderly form of presentation, and then in different books to lay down and explain the required characteristics of different departments. Hence, Caesar, in my first book I have set forth to you the function of the architect and the things in which he ought to be trained. In the second I have discussed the supplies of material of which buildings are constructed. In the third, which deals with the arrangements of temples and their variety of form, I show the nature and number of their classes, with the adjustments proper to each form according to the usage of the Ionic order, one of the three which exhibit the greatest delicacy of proportion in their symmetrical measurements. In the present book I shall speak of the established rules for the Doric and Corinthian order, and shall explain the differences and peculiarities. Chapter 1. The origins of the three orders and the proportions of the Corinthian capital. 1. Corinthian columns are, excepting in their capitals, of the same proportions in all respects as Ionic, but the height of their capitals gives them proportionately a taller and more slender effect. This is because the height of the Ionic capital is only one-third of the thickness of the column, while that of the Corinthian is the entire thickness of the shaft. Hence, as two-thirds are added in the Corinthian capitals, their tallness gives a more slender appearance to the columns themselves. 2. The other members which are placed above the columns are for Corinthian columns composed either of the Doric proportions or according to the Ionic usages, for the Corinthian order never had any scheme peculiar to itself for its cornices or other ornaments, but may have mutules in the coronae and guttae on the architraves according to the triglyph system of the Doric style, or, according to Ionic practices, it may be arranged with a frieze adorned with sculptures and accompanied with dentils and coronae. 3. Thus a third architectural order, distinguished by its capital, was produced out of the two other orders. To the forms of their columns are due the names of the three orders, Doric, Ionic, and Corinthian, of which the Doric was the first to arise and in early times, for Doris, the son of Helen, and the nymph Phthia, was king of Achaia and all the Peloponnesus, and he built a fane, which chanced to be of this order, in the precinct of Juno at Argolis, a very ancient city, and subsequently others of the same order in the other cities of Achaia, although the rules of symmetry were not yet in existence. 4. Later, the Athenians, in obedience to oracles of the Delphic Apollo and with the general agreement of all Hellas, dispatched 13 colonies at one time to Asia Minor, appointing leaders for each colony and giving the command-in-chief to Ion, son of Xuthus and Croesa, whom further Apollo at Delphi in the oracles had acknowledged as his son. Ion conducted those colonies to Asia Minor, took possession of the land of Caria, and there founded the grand cities of Ephesus, Miletus, Myus, long ago engulfed by the water, and its sacred rites and suffrage handed over by the Ionians to the Milesians. Priene, Samos, Teos, Colophon, Caius, Erythrae, Phocaeae, Clazomenae, Lebedos, and Melite. This Melite, on account of the arrogance of its citizens, was destroyed by the other cities in a war declared by general agreement, and in its place, through the kindness of King Attalus and Arsinoe, the city of the Smyrnians was admitted among the Ionians. 5. Now these cities, after driving out the Carians and Lilligans, called that part of the world Ionia from their leader Ion. And there they set off precincts for the immortal gods and began to build fanes. First of all, a temple to Panionian Apollo, such as they had seen in Achaia, calling it Doric because they had first seen that kind of temple built in the states of the Dorians. 6. Wishing to set up columns in that temple, but not having rules for their symmetry and being in search of some way by which they could render them fit to bear a load, and also of a satisfactory beauty of appearance, they measured the imprint of a man's foot and compared this with his height. On finding that, in a man, the foot was one-sixth of the height, they applied the same principle to the column, and reared the shaft, including the capital, to a height 6 times its thickness at its base. Thus the Doric column, as used in buildings, began to exhibit the proportions, strength, and beauty of the body of a man. 7. Just so afterwards, when they desired to construct a temple to Diana in a new style of beauty, they translated these footprints into terms characteristic of the slenderness of women, and thus first made a column the thickness of which was only 1/8 of its height, so that it might have a taller look. At the foot they substituted the base in place of a shoe, In the capital they placed the volutes, hanging down at the right and left like curly ringlets, and ornamented its front with cymatia and with festoons of fruit arranged in place of hair, while they brought the flutes down the whole shaft, falling like the folds in the robes worn by matrons. Thus in the invention of the two different kinds of columns they borrowed manly beauty, naked and unadorned, for the one and for the other the delicacy, adornment, and proportions characteristic of women. 8. It is true that posterity, having made progress in refinement and delicacy of feeling, and finding pleasure in more slender proportions, has established 7 diameters of the thickness as the height of the Doric column, and 9 as that of the Ionic. The Ionians, however, originated the order which is therefore named Ionic. The third order, called Corinthian, is an imitation of the slenderness of a maiden, for the outlines and limbs of maidens, being more slender on account of their tender years, admit of prettier effects in the way of adornment. 9. It is related that the original discovery of this form of capital was as follows. A free-born maiden of Corinth, just of marriageable age, was attacked by an illness and passed away. After her burial, her nurse, collecting a few little things which used to give the girl pleasure while she was alive, put them in a basket, carried it to the tomb and laid it on top thereof, covering it with a roof tile so that the things might last longer in the open air. This basket happened to be placed just above the root of an acanthus. The acanthus root, pressed down meanwhile, though it was by the weight, when springtime came round, put forth leaves and stalks in the middle, and the stalks growing up along the sides of the basket, and pressed out by the corners of the tile through the compulsion of its weight, were forced to bend into volutes at the outer edges. 10. Just then, Callimachus, whom the Athenian called Katatechitechnos, for the refinement and delicacy of his artistic work, passed by this tome and observed the basket with the tender young leaves growing around it. Delighted with the novel style and form, he built some columns after that pattern for the Corinthians, determined their symmetrical proportions, and established from that time forth the rules to be followed in finished works of the Corinthian order. 11. The proportions of this capital should be fixed as follows. Let the height of the capital, including its abacus, be equivalent to the thickness of the base of a column. Let the breadth of the abacus be proportioned so that the diagonals drawn from one corner of it to the other shall be twice the height of the capitals, which will give the proper breadth to each face of the abacus. The faces should curve inwards by 1/9 of the breadth of the face from the outside edge of the corners of the abacus. At the bottom, the capital should be of the thickness of the top of the column, omitting the conge and astragal. The height of the abacus is 1/7 of the height of the capital. 12. Omitting the height of the abacus, let the rest be divided into 3 parts, of which one should be given to the lowest leaf. Let the second leaf occupy the middle part of the height. Of the same height should be the stalks, out of which grow leaves projected so as to support the volutes which proceed from the stalks and run out to the utmost corners of the abacus. The smaller spirals between them should be carved just under the flower which is on the abacus. The flowers on the 4 sides are to be made as large as the height of the abacus. On these principles of proportion, Corinthian capitals will be finished as they ought to be. There are other kinds of capitals set upon these columns and called by various names, but they have no peculiarities of proportion of which we can speak, nor can we recognize from them another order of columns. Even their very names are, as we can see, derived with some changes from the Corinthian, the cushion-shaped, and the Doric, whose symmetrical proportions have been thus transferred to delicate sculptures of novel form. Chapter 2. The Ornaments of the Orders. 1. Since the origin and invention of the orders of columns have been described above, I think it not out of place to speak in the same way about their ornaments, showing how these arose and from what original elements they were devised. The upper parts of all buildings contain timberwork, to which various terms are applied, and not only in its terminology, but actually in its uses, it exhibits variety. The main beams are those which are laid upon columns, pilasters, and anti. Tie beams and rafters are found in the framing. Under the roof, if the span is pretty large, are the crossbeams and struts. If it is of moderate extent, only the ridgepole, with the principal rafters extending to the outer edge of the eaves. Over the principal rafters are the purlins, and then above these and under the roof tiles come the common rafters, extending so far that the walls are covered by their projection. 2. Thus each and every detail has a place, origin, and order of its own. In accordance with these details, and starting from carpenter's work, artists in building temples of stone and marble imitated those arrangements in their sculptures, believing that they must follow those inventions. So it was that some ancient carpenters, engaged in building somewhere or other, after laying the tie beams so that they projected from the inside to the outside of the walls, closed up the space between the beams, and above them ornamented the coronae and gables with carpentry work of beauty greater than usual. Then they cut off the projecting ends of the beams, bringing them into line and flush with the face of the walls. Next, as this had an ugly look to them, they fastened boards, shaped as triglyphs are now made, on the ends of the beams, where they had been cut off in front, and painted them with blue wax, so that the cutting off of the ends of the beams, being concealed, would not offend the eye. Hence it was an imitation of the arrangement of the tie beams that men began to employ, in Doric buildings, the device of triglyphs and the metopes between the beams. 3. Later, others in other buildings allowed the projecting principal rafters to run out till they were flush with the triglyphs and then formed their projections into simae. From that practice, like the triglyphs, from the arrangements of the tie beams, the system of mutules under the coronae was devised from the projections of the principal rafters. Hence, generally, in buildings of stone and marble, the mutules are carved with a downward slant, in imitation of the principal rafters. For these necessarily have a slanting and projecting position to let the water drip down. The scheme of triglyphs and mutules in Doric buildings was therefore the imitative device that I have described. 4. It cannot be that the triglyphs represent windows, as some have erroneously said, since the triglyphs are placed at the corners and over the middle of the columns, places where, from the nature of the case, there can be no windows at all. For buildings are wholly disconnected at the corners if openings for windows are left at those points. Again, if we are to suppose that there were open windows where the triglyphs now stand, it will follow on the same principle that the dentils of the Ionic order have likewise taken the places of windows. For the term metope is used of the intervals between dentils as well as of those between triglyphs. The Greeks called the seats of tie beams and rafters opi, while our people call these cavities columbaria, dovecotes. Hence the space between the tie beams, being the space between two opi, was named by them metope. 5. The system of triglyphs and mutules was invented for the Doric order, and similarly the scheme of dentils belonging to the Ionic, in which there are proper grounds for its use in buildings. Just as mutules represent the projection of the principal rafters, so dentils in the Ionic are an imitation of the projections of the common rafters. And so in Greek works nobody ever put dentils under mutules, as it is impossible that common rafters should be underneath principal rafters. Therefore, if that which in the original must be placed above the principal rafters is put in the copy below them, the result will be a work constructed on false principles. Neither did the ancients approve of or employ mutules or dentils in pediments, but only plain coronae, for the reason that neither principal nor common rafters tail into the front of pediments, nor can they overhang them, but they are laid with a slope towards the eaves. Hence the ancients held that what could not happen in the original would have no valid reason for existence in the copy. 6. For in all their works they proceeded on definite principles of fitness and in ways derived from the truth of nature. Thus they reached perfection, approving only those things which, if challenged, can be explained on grounds of the truth. Hence, from the sources which have been described, they established and left us the rules of symmetry and proportion for each order. Following in their steps, I have spoken above on the Ionic and Corinthian style, and I shall now briefly explain the theory of the Doric and its general appearance. End of Book 4, Chapter 2. Book 4, Chapters 3-5 of 10 Books on Architecture. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Fredrik Karlsson. 10 Books on Architecture by Vitruvius. Translated by Morris Hickey Morgan. Chapter 3. Proportions of Doric Temples. 1. Some of the ancient architects said that the Doric order ought not to be used for temples, because faults and incongruities were caused by the laws of its symmetry. Arcesius and Pythius said so, as well as Hermogenes. He, for instance, after getting together a supply of marble for the construction of a Doric temple, changed his mind and built an Ionic temple to Father Bacchus with the same materials. This is not because it is unlovely in appearance or origin or dignity of form, but because the arrangement of the triglyphs and metopes lacunaria is an embarrassment and inconvenience to the work. 2. For the triglyphs ought to be placed so as to correspond to the centers of the columns, and the metopes between the triglyphs ought to be as broad as they are high. But in violation of this rule, at the corner columns, triglyphs are placed at the outside edges and not corresponding to the center of the columns. Hence, the metopes next to the corner columns do not come out perfectly square, but are too broad by half the width of a triglyph. Those who would make the metopes all alike make the outermost intercolumniations narrower by half the width of a triglyph. But the result is faulty, whether it is attained by broader metopes or narrower intercolumniations. For this reason, the ancients appear to have avoided the scheme of the Doric order in their temples. 3. However, since our plan calls for it, we set it forth as we have received it from our teachers, so that if anybody cares to set to work with attention to these laws, he may find the proportions stated by which he can construct correct and faultless examples of temples in the Doric fashion. Let the front of a Doric temple, at the place where the columns are put up, be divided, if it is to be tetrastyle, into 27 parts, if hexastyle, into 42. One of these parts will be the module, in Greek, embates, and this module once fixed, all the parts of the work are adjusted by means of calculations based upon it. 4. The thickness of the columns will be 2 modules, and their height, including the capitals, 14. The height of a capital will be 1 module, and its breadth 2 1/6 modules. Let the height of the capital be divided into 3 parts, of which one will form the abacus with the cymatium, the second the echinus with its annulets, and the third the necking. The diminution of the column should be the same as described for Ionic columns in the third book. The height of the architrave, including taenia and guttae, is 1 module, and of the taenia 1/7 of a module. The guttae, extending as wide as the triglyphs and beneath the taenia, should hang down for 1/6 of a module, including the regula. The depth of the architrave on its underside should answer to the necking at the top of the column. Above the architrave, the triglyphs and metopes are to be placed, the triglyphs 1.5 modules high and 1 module wide in front. They are to be arranged so that one is placed to correspond to the center of each corner and intermediate column, and 2 over each intercolumniations, except the middle intercolumniations of the front and rear porticos, which have 3 each. The intervals in the middle being thus extended, a free passage will be afforded to those who would approach the statues of the gods. 5. The width of the triglyph should be divided into 6 parts, and 5 of these marked off in the middle by means of the rule, and 2 half parts of the right and left. Let one part, that in the center, form a femur, in Greek meros. On each side of it are the channels, to be cut in to fit the tip of a carpenter's square, and in succession the other femora, one at the right and one at the left of a channel. To the outsides are relegated the semichannels. The triglyphs having been thus arranged, let the metopes between the triglyphs be as high as they are wide, while at the outer corners there should be semi-metopes inserted, with a width of 1/2 a module. In these ways, all defects will be corrected, whether in metopes or intercolumniations or lacunaria, as all the arrangements have been made with uniformity. 6. The capitals of each triglyph are to measure 1/6 of a module. Over the capitals of the triglyphs, the corona is to be placed with a projection of 2/3 of a module, and having a Doric cymatium at the bottom and another at the top. so the corona with its armatura is half a module in height. Set off under the underside of the corona, vertically under the triglyph and over the middle of the metopes, are the via in the straight lines and the guttae arranged in rows, 6 guttae broad and 3 deep. The spaces left, due to the fact that the metopes are broader than the triglyphs, may be left unornamented or may have thunderbolts carved on them. Just at the edge of the corona a line should be cut in, called the scotia. All the other parts, such as the tympana and the simae of the corona, are to be constructed as described above in the case of the Ionic order. 7. Such will be the scheme established for diastyle buildings. But if the building is to be systyle and monotriglyphic, let the front of the temple, if tetrastyle, be divided into 19.5 parts, if hexastyle, into 29.5 parts. One of these parts will form the module in accordance with which the adjustments are to be made as above described. 8. Thus over each portion of the architrave 2 metopes and 2 triglyphs will be placed, and, in addition, at the corners half a triglyph, and besides a space large enough for a half triglyph. At the center, vertically under the gable, there should be room for 3 triglyphs and 3 metopes, in order that the center intercolumniation by its greater width may give ample room for people to enter the temple and may lend an imposing effect to the view of the statues of the gods. 9. The columns should be fluted with 20 flutes. If these are to be left plain, only the 20 angles need to be marked off. But if they are to be channeled out, the contour of the channeling may be determined thus. Draw a square with sides equal in length to the breadth of fluting, and center a pair of compasses in the middle of this square. Then describe a circle with a circumference touching the angles of the square, and let the channelings have the contour of the segment formed by the circumference and the side of the square. The fluting of the Doric column will thus be finished in the style appropriate to it. 10. With regard to the enlargement to be made in the column at its middle, let the description given for Ionic temple in the third book be applied here also in the case of Doric. Since the external appearance of the Corinthian, Doric, and Ionic proportions has now been described, it is necessary next to explain the arrangements of the cella and the pronaos. Chapter 4. The cella and the pronaos. 1. The length of a temple is adjusted so that its width may be half its length and the actual cella 1/4 greater in length than in width, including the wall in which the folding doors are placed. Let the remaining 3 parts constituting the pronaos extend to the antae terminating the walls, which antae ought to be of the same thickness as the columns. If the temple is to be more than 20 feet in width, let 2 columns be placed between the 2 antae, and separate the pteroma from the pronaos. The 3 intercolumniations between the antae and the columns should be closed by low walls made of marble or of joiner's work, with doors in them to afford passages into the pronaos. 2. If the width is to be more than 40 feet, let columns be placed inside and opposite to the columns between the antae. They should have the same height as the column in front of them, but their thickness should be proportionately reduced. Thus, if the columns in front are in thickness 1/8 of their height, these should be 1/10. If the former are 1/9 or 1/10, they should be reduced in the same proportion, for their reduction will not be discernible as the air has not free play about them. Still, in case they look too slender when the outer columns have 20 or 24 flutes, these may have 28 or 32. Thus the additional number of flutes will make up proportionately for the loss in the body of the shaft, preventing it from being seen, and so in a different way the column will be made to look equally thick. 3. The reason for this result is that I, touching thus upon a greater number of points set closer together, has a larger compass to cover with its range of vision. For if 2 columns, equally thick but one unfluted and the other fluted, are measured by drawing lines round them, one line touching the body of the columns in the hollows of the channels and on the edges of the flutes, these surrounding lines, even through the columns are equally thick, will not be equal to each other, because it takes a line of greater length to compass the channels and the flutes. This being granted, it is not improper, in narrow quarters or where the space is enclosed, to use in a building columns of somewhat slender proportions, since we can help out by a duly proportionate number of flutings. 4. The walls of the cella itself should be thick in proportion to its size, provided that their antae are kept of the same thickness as the columns. If the walls are to be of masonry, let the rubble used be as small as possible, but if they are to be of dimension stone or marble, the material ought to be of very moderate and uniform size, for the laying of the stone so as to break joints will make the whole work stronger, and their beveled edges, standing about the builds and beds, will give it an agreeable look, somewhat like that of a picture. Chapter 5. How the temple should face. 1. The quarter toward which temples of the immortal gods ought to face is to be determined on the principle that, if there is no reason to hinder and the choice is free, the temple and the statue placed in the cella should face the western quarter of the sky. This will enable those who approach the altar with offerings and sacrifices to face the direction of the sunrise in facing the statue in the temple, and thus those who are undertaking vows look toward the quarters from which the sun come forth, and likewise the statues themselves appear to be coming forth out of the east to look upon them as they pray and sacrifice. 2. But if the nature of the site is such as to forbid this, then the principle of determining the quarter should be changed so that the widest possible view of the city may be had from the sanctuaries of the gods. Furthermore, temples that are to be built beside rivers, as in Egypt on both sides of the Nile, ought, as it seems, to face the river banks. Similarly, houses of the gods on the sides of public roads should be arranged so that the passers-by can have a view of them and pay their devotions face to face. End of Book 4, Chapter 5. Book 4, Chapters 6 to 9 of 10 Books on Architecture. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Fredrik Karlsson. 10 Books on Architecture by Vitruvius, translated by Morris Hickey Morgan. Chapter 6. The Doorways of Temples. 1. For the doorways of temples and their casings, the rules are as follows. First, determining of what styles they are to be. The styles of portals are Doric, Ionic, and Attic. In the Doric, the symmetrical proportions are distinguished by the following rules. Let the top of the corona, which is laid above the casing, be on a level with the tops of the capitals of the columns in the pronaos. The aperture of the doorway should be determined by dividing the height of the temple from floor to coffered ceiling into 3.5 parts, and letting 2.5 thereof constitute the height of the aperture of the folding doors. Let this in turn be divided into 12 parts, and let 5.5 of these form the width of the bottom of the aperture. At the top, this width should be diminished, if the aperture is 16 feet in height, by 1/3 the width of the door jamb. If the aperture is from 16 to 25 feet, let the upper part of it be diminished by 1/4 of the jamb. If from 25 to 30 feet, let the top be diminished by 1/8 of the jamb. Other and higher apertures should, as it seems, have their sides perpendicular. 2. Further, the jambs themselves should be diminished at the top by 1/14 of their width. The height of the lintel should be equivalent to the width of the jambs at the top. Its cymatium ought to be 1/6 of the jamb, with a projection equivalent to its height. The style of carving of the cymatium with its astragal should be the Lesbian. Above the cymatium of the lintel, place the frieze of the doorway of the same height as the lintel and having a Doric cymatium and Lesbian astragal carved upon it. Let the corona and its cymatium at the top of all be carved without ornamentation and have a projection equal to its height. To the right and left of the lintel, which rests upon the jambs, there are to be projections fashioned like projecting bases and jointed to a nicety with the cymatium itself. 3. If the doorways are to be of the Ionic style, the height of the aperture should be reached in the same manner as in the Doric. Let its width be determined by dividing the height into 2.5 parts and letting one of them form the width at the bottom. The diminution should be the same as for Doric. The width of the faces of the jambs should be 1/14 of the height of the aperture, and the cymatium 1/6 of the width. Let the rest, excluding the cymatium, be divided into 12 parts. Let three of these compose the first fascia with its astragal, four the second, and five the third, the fascia with their astragals running side by side all around. 4. The cornices of Ionic doorways should be constructed in the same manner as those of Doric, in due proportions. The consoles, otherwise called brackets, carved at the right and left, should hang down to the level of the bottom of the lintel, exclusive of the leaf. Their width on the face should be 2/3 of the width of the jamb, but at the bottom 1/4 slenderer than above. Doors should be constructed with the hinge stiles 1/12 of the width of the whole aperture. The panels between two stiles should each occupy 3 of the 12 parts. 5. The rails will be apportioned thus. Divide the height into 5 parts, of which assign 2 to the upper portions and 3 to the lower. Above the center, place the middle rails, insert the others at the top and at the bottom. Let the height of a rail be 1/3 of the breadth of a panel, and its cymatium 1/6 of the rail. The width of the meeting stiles should be 1/2 the rail, and the covered joint 2/3 of the rail. The stiles toward the sides of the jambs should be 1/2 the rail. If the doors have folds in them, the height will remain as before, but the width should be double that of a single door. If the door is to have 4 folds, its height should be increased. 6. Attic doorways are built with the same proportions as Doric. Besides, there are fasciae running all around under the cymatia on the jambs, and a portion so as to be equal to 3/7 of a jamb, excluding the cymatium. The doors are without lattice work, are not double, but have folds in them, and open outward. The laws which should govern the design of temples built in the Doric, Ionic, and Corinthian styles have now, so far as I could arrive at them, been set forth according to what may be called the accepted methods. I shall next speak of the arrangements in the Tuscan style, showing how they should be treated. Chapter 7. Tuscan Temples. 1. The place where the temple is to be built, having been divided on its length into 6 parts, deduct 1, and let the rest be given to its width. Then let the length be divided into 2 equal parts, of which let the inner be reserved a space for the cella, and the part next the front left for the arrangement of the columns. 2. Next let the width be divided into 10 parts. Of these, let 3 on the right and 3 on the left be given to the smaller cellae, or to the alae if there are to be alae, and the other 4 devoted to the middle of the temple. Let the space in front of the cellae, in the pronaos, be marked out for columns thus. The corner columns should be placed opposite the antae on the line of the outside walls, the 2 middle columns set out on the line of the walls which are between the antae and the middle of the temple, and through the middle, between the antae and the front columns, a second row arranged on the same lines. Let the thickness of the columns at the bottom be 1/7 of their height 1/3 of the width of the temple, and the diminution of a column at the top 1/4 of its thickness at the bottom. 3. The height of their bases should be 1/2 of that thickness. The plinth of their bases should be circular, and in height 1/2 the height of the bases, the torus above it and conge being of the same height as the plinth. The height of the capital is 1/2 of the thickness of a column. The abacus has a width equivalent to the thickness of the bottom of a column. Let the height of the capital be divided into 3 parts, and give 1 to the plinth, that is, the abacus, the second to the echinus, and the third to the necking with its conge. 4. Upon the columns lay the main beams, fastened together, to a height commensurate with the requirements of the size of the building. These beams, fastened together, should be laid so as to be equivalent in thickness to the necking at the top of a column, and should be fastened together by means of dowels and dovetailed tenons in such a way that there shall be a space 2 fingers broad between them at the fastening. For if they touch one another, and so do not leave air holes and admit draughts of air to blow between them, they get heated and soon begin to rot. 5. Above the beams and walls let the mutules project to a distance equal to 1/4 of the height of a column, along the front of them nail casings. Above build the tympanum of the pediment either in masonry or in wood. The pediment with its ridgepole, principal rafters, and purlins are to be built in such a way that the eaves shall be equivalent to 1/3 of the completed roof. Chapter 8. circular temples and other varieties. 1. There are also circular temples, some of which are constructed in monopteral form, surrounded by columns, but without a cella, while others are termed peripteral. Those that are without a cella have a raised platform and a flight of steps leading to it, 1/3 of the diameter of the temple. The columns upon the stylobates are constructed of a height equivalent to the diameter taken between the outer edges of the stylobate walls, and of a thickness equivalent to 1/10 of their height, including the capitals and bases. The architrave has the height of 1/2 of the thickness of a column. The frieze and the other parts placed above it are such as I have described in the third book on the subject of symmetrical proportions. 2. But if such a temple is to be constructed in peripteral form, let 2 steps and then the stylobate be constructed below. Next, let the cella wall be set up, recessed with the stylobate about 1/5 of the breadth thereof, and let a place for folding doors be left in the middle to afford entrance. This cella, excluding its walls and the passage round the outside, should have a diameter equivalent to the height of a column above the stylobate. Let the columns round the cella be arranged in the symmetrical proportions just given. 3. The proportions of the roof in the center should be such that the height of the rotunda, excluding the finial, is equivalent to 1/2 the diameter of the whole work. The finial, excluding its pyramidal base, should have the dimensions of the capital of a column. All the rest must be built in the symmetrical proportions described above. 4. There are also other kinds of temples constructed in the same symmetrical proportions and yet with a different kind of plan. For example, the temple of Castor in the district of Circus Flaminius, that of Vejovis between the two groves, and still more ingeniously the temple of Diana in her sacred grove, with columns added on the right and left at the flanks of the pronaos. Temples of this kind, like that of Castor in the Circus, were first built in Athens on the Acropolis and in Attica at Sunium to Pallas Minerva. The proportions of them are not different, but the same as usual. For the length of their cellae is twice the width as in other temples, but all that we regularly find in the fronts of the others is in these transferred to the sides. 5. Some take the arrangement of columns belonging to the Tuscan order and apply it to buildings in the Corinthian and Ionic style, and where they are projecting anti in the pronaos, set up 2 columns in a line with each of their cella walls, thus making a combination of the principles of Tuscan and Greek buildings. 6. Others actually remove the temple walls, transferring them to the intercolumniations, and thus, by dispensing with the space needed for a pteroma, greatly increase the extent of the cella. So, while leaving all the rest in the same symmetrical proportions, they appear to have produced a new kind of plan with a new name, pseudo-peripteral. These kinds, however, vary according to the requirements of the sacrifices. For we must not build temples according to the same rules to all gods alike, since the performance of the sacred rites varies with the various gods. 7. I have now set forth, as they have come down to me, all the principles governing the building of temples, have marked out under separate heads their arrangements and proportions, and have set forth, so far as I could express them in writing, the differences in their plans, and the distinctions which make them unlike one another. Next, with regard to the altars of the immortal gods, I shall state how they may be constructed so as to conform to the rules governing sacrifices. Chapter 9. Altars. Altars should face the east and should always be placed on a lower level than are the statues in the temple, so that those who are praying and sacrificing may look upwards towards the divinity. They are of different heights, being each regulated so as to be appropriate to its own god. The heights are to be adjusted thus. For Jupiter and all the celestials, let them be constructed as high as possible. For Vesta and Mother Earth, let them be built low. In accordance with these rules, will altars be adjusted when one is preparing his plans. Having described the arrangements of temples in this book, in the following we shall give an exposition of the construction of public buildings. End of Book 4. Book 5, Introduction, and Chapters 1 to 3 of 10 Books on Architecture. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Fredrik Karlsson. 10 Books on Architecture by Vitruvius, translated by Morris Hickey Morgan. Book 5, Introduction. 1. Those who have filled books of unusually large size, Emperor, in setting forth their intellectual ideas and doctrines, have thus made a very great and remarkable addition to the authority of their writings. I could wish that circumstances made this as permissible in the case of our subject, so that the authority of the present treatise might be increased by amplifications. But this is not so easy as it may be thought. Writing on architecture is not like history or poetry. History is captivating to the reader from its very nature, for it holds out the hope of various novelties. Poetry, with its measures and metrical feet, its refinement in the arrangements of words, and the delivery in verse of the sentiments expressed by the several characters to one another, delights the feelings of the reader, and leads him smoothly on to the very end of the work. 2. But this cannot be the case with architectural treatises, because those terms which originate in the peculiar needs of the art give rise to obscurity of ideas from the unusual nature of the language. Hence, while the things themselves are not well known and their names not in common use, if besides this the principles are described in a very diffuse fashion without any attempt at conciseness and explanation in a few pellucid sentences, such fullness and amplitude of treatment will be only a hindrance and will give the reader nothing but indefinite notions. Therefore, when I mention obscure terms and the symmetrical proportions of members of buildings, I shall give brief explanations so that they may be committed to memory, for thus expressed the mind will be enabled to understand them the more easily. 3. Furthermore, since I have observed that our citizens are distracted with public affairs and private business, I have thought it best to write briefly so that my readers, whose intervals of leisure are small, may be able to comprehend in a short time. Then again, Pythagoras and those who came after him in his school thought it proper to employ the principles of the cube in composing books on their doctrines, and, having determined that the cube consisted of 216 lines, held that there should be no more than 3 cubes in any one treatise. 4. A cube is a body with sides all of equal breadth and their surfaces perfectly square. When thrown down, it stands firm and steady so long as it is untouched, no matter on which of its side it has fallen, like the dice which players throw in the board. The Pythagoreans appear to have drawn their analogy from the cube, because the number of lines mentioned will be fixed firmly and steadily in the memory when they have once settled down, like a cube, upon a man's understanding. The Greek comic poets also divided their plays into parts by introducing a choral song, and by this partition on the principle of the cubes they relieve the actors' speeches by such intermissions. 5. Since these rules, founded on the analogy of nature, were followed by our predecessors, and since I observe that I have to write on unusual subjects which many persons will find obscure, I have thought it best to write in short books, so that they may the more readily strike the understanding of the reader, for they will thus be easy to comprehend. I have also arranged them so that those in search of knowledge on a subject may not have to gather it from different places, but may find it in one complete treatment, with the various classes set forth each in a book by itself. Hence, Caesar, in the 3rd and 4th book I gave the rules for temples. In this book I shall treat of the laying out of public places. I shall speak first of the proper arrangement of the forum, for in it the course of both public and private affairs is directed by the magistrates. Chapter 1. The Forum and Basilica. 1. The Greeks lay out their forums in the form of a square surrounded by very spacious double colonnades, adorn them with columns set rather closely together and with entablatures of stone or marble, and construct walks above in the upper story. But in the cities of Italy the same method cannot be followed, for the reason that it is a custom handed down from our ancestors that gladiatorial shows should be given in the forum. 2. Therefore let the intercolumniations around the show place be pretty wide. Round about in the colonnades put the bankers' offices, and have balconies on the upper floor properly arranged so as to be convenient, and to bring in some public revenue. The size of a forum should be proportionate to the number of inhabitants, so that it may not be too small a space to be useful, nor look like a desert waste for lack of population. To determine its breadth, divide its length into three parts and assign two of them to the breadth. Its shape will then be oblong, and its ground plan conveniently suited to the conditions of shows. 3. The columns of the upper tier should be 1/4 smaller than those of the lower, because, for the purpose of bearing the load, what is below ought to be stronger than what is above, and also because we ought to imitate nature as seen in the case of things growing. For example, in round smooth-stemmed trees like the fir, cypress, and pine, every one of which is rather thick just above the roots, and then, as it goes on increasing in height, tapers off naturally and symmetrically in growing up to the top. Hence, if nature requires this in things growing, it is the right arrangement that what is above should be less in height and thickness than what is below. 4. Basilicas should be constructed on a site adjoining the forum and in the warmest possible quarter, so that in winter businessmen may gather in them without being troubled by the weather. In breadth they should be not less than 1/3 nor more than 1/2 of their length, unless the site is naturally such as to prevent this and to oblige an alteration in these proportions. If the length of the site is greater than necessary, Chalcedian porches may be constructed at the ends, as in the Julia Aquilana. 5. It is thought that the columns of basilicas ought to be as high as the side aisles are broad. An aisle should be limited to 1/3 of the breadth which the open space in the middle is to have. Let the columns of the upper tier be smaller than those of the lower, as written above. The screen to be placed between the upper and the lower tiers of the columns ought to be, it is thought, 1/4 lower than the columns of the upper tier, so that people walking in the upper story of the basilica may not be seen by the businessmen. The architraves, friezes, and cornices should be adjusted to the proportions of the columns, as we have stated in the third book. 6. But basilicas of the greatest dignity and beauty may also be constructed in the style of that one which I erected, and the building of which I superintended at Fano. Its proportions and symmetrical relations were established as follows. In the middle, the main roof between the columns is 120 feet long and 60 feet wide. Its aisle around the space beneath the main roof and between the walls and the columns is 20 feet broad. The columns, of unbroken height, measuring with their capitals 50 feet and being each 5 feet thick, have behind them pilasters, 20 feet high, 2.5 feet broad, and 1.5 feet thick, which support the beams on which is carried the upper flooring of the aisles. Above them are other pilasters, 18 feet high, 2 feet broad, and 1 foot thick, which carry the beams supporting the principal raftering in the roof of the aisles, which is brought down lower than the main roof. 7. The spaces remaining between the beams, supported by the pilasters and the columns, are left for windows between the intercolumniations. The columns are, on the breadth of the main roof at each end, 4, including the corner columns at right and left. On the long side, which is next to the forum, 8, including the same corner columns. On the other side, 6, including the corner columns. This is because the two middle columns on that side are omitted, in order not to obstruct the view of the pronaos of the temple of Augustus, which is built at the middle of the side wall of the basilica, facing the middle of the forum and the temple of Jupiter, and also the tribunal which is in the former temple, shaped as a hemicycle whose curvature is less than a semicircle. 8. The open side of this hemicycle is 4 to 6 feet along the front, and its curvature inwards is 15 feet, so that those who are standing before the magistrates may not be in the way of the businessmen in the basilica. Round about, above the columns, are placed the architraves, consisting of 3 2-foot timbers fastened together. These return from the columns which stand third on the inner side to the anti which project from the pronaos, and which touch the edges of the hemicycle at right and left. 9. Above the architraves, and regularly dispersed on supports directly over the capitals, piers are placed, 3 feet high and 4 feet broad each way. Above them is placed the projecting cornice roundabout, made of 2 2-foot timbers. the tie beams and struts being placed above them, and directly over the shafts of the columns and the antae and the walls of the pronaos, hold up one gable roof along the entire basilica, and another one from the middle of it, over the pronaos of the temple. 10. Thus the gable tops run in two directions, like the letter T, and give a beautiful effect to the outside and inside of the main roof. Further, by the omission of an ornamental entablature and of a line of screens and a second tier of columns, troublesome labor is saved and the total cost greatly diminished. On the other hand, the carrying of the columns themselves in unbroken height directly up to the beams that support the main roof seems to add an air of sumptuousness and dignity to the work. Chapter 2. The Treasury, Prison and Senate House. 1. The treasury, prison, and senate house ought to adjoin the forum, but in such a way that their dimensions may be proportionate to those of the forum. Particularly, the senate house should be constructed with special regard to the importance of the town or city. If the building is square, let its height be fixed at 1.5 times its breadth, but if it is to be oblong, add together its length and breadth, and, having got the total, let half of it be devoted to the height up to the coffered ceiling. 2. Further, the inside walls should be girdled at a point halfway up their height with coronae made of woodwork or of stucco. Without these, the voice of men engaged in discussion there will be carried up to the height above, and so be unintelligible to their listeners. But when the walls are girdled with coronae, the voice from below, being detained before rising and becoming lost in the air, will be intelligible to the ear. Chapter 3. The Theatre, Its Site, Foundations and Acoustics. 1. After the forum has been arranged, next, for the purpose of seeing plays or festivals of the immortal gods, a site as healthy as possible should be selected for the theatre, in accordance with what has been written in the first book, on the principles of healthfulness in the sides of cities. For when plays are given, the spectators, with their wives and children, sit through them spellbound, and their bodies, motionless from enjoyment, have their pores open into which blowing winds find their way. If these winds come from marshy districts or from other unwholesome quarters, they will introduce noxious exhalations into the system. Hence, such faults will be avoided if the site of the theatre is somewhat carefully selected. 2. We must also beware that it has not a southern exposure. When the sun shines full upon the rounded part of it, the air, being shut up in the curved enclosure and unable to circulate, stays there and becomes heated, and getting glowing hot, it burns up, dries out, and impairs the fluids of the human body. For these reasons, sites which are unwholesome in such respects are to be avoided, and healthy sites selected. 3. The foundation walls will be an easier matter if they are on a hillside, but if they have to be laid out on a plain or in a marshy place, solidity must be assured, and substructures built in accordance with what has been written in the third book on the foundations of temples. Above the foundation walls, the ascending rows of seats from the substructures up should be built of stone and marble materials. 4. The curved cross aisles should be constructed in proportionate relation, it is thought, to the height of the theatre, but not higher than the footway of the passage is broad. If they are loftier, they will throw back the voice and drive it away from the upper portions, thus preventing the case endings of words from reaching with distinct meaning the ears of those who are in the uppermost seats above the cross aisles. In short, it should be so contrived that a line drawn from the lowest to the highest seat will touch the top edges and angles of all the seats. Thus the voice will meet with no obstruction. 5. The different entrances ought to be numerous and spacious, the upper not connected with the lower, but built in a continuous straight line from all parts of the house, without turning, so that the people may not be crowded together when let out from the shows, but may have separate exits from all parts without obstructions. Particular pains must also be taken that the sight be not a deaf one, but one through which the voice can range with the greatest clearness. This can be brought about if a sight is selected where there is no obstruction due to echo. 6. Voice is a flowing breath of air, perceptible to the hearing by contact. It moves in an endless number of circular rounds, like the innumerably increasing circular waves which appear when a stone is thrown into smooth water, and which keep on spreading indefinitely from the center unless interrupted by narrow limits or by some obstruction which prevents such waves from reaching their end in due formation. When they are interrupted by obstructions, the first waves, flowing back, break up the formation of those which follow. 7. In the same manner, the voice executes its movements in concentric circles, by while in the case of water the circles move horizontally on a plane surface, the voice not only proceeds horizontally, but also ascends vertically by regular stages. Therefore, as in the case of the waves formed in the water, so it is in the case of the voice. The first wave, when there is no obstruction to interrupt it, does not break up the second or the following waves, but they all reach the ears of the lowest and highest spectators without an echo. 8. Hence the ancient architects, following in the footsteps of nature, perfected the ascending rows of seats in theatres from their investigations of the ascending voice, and, by means of the canonical theory of the mathematicians and that of the musicians, endeavored to make every voice uttered on the stage come with greater clearness and sweetness to the ears of the audience. For just as musical instruments are brought to perfection of clearness in the sound of their strings by means of bronze plates or horn, so the ancient devised methods of increasing the power of the voice in theatres through the application of harmonics. End of Book 5, Chapter 3. Book 5, Chapters 4 and 5 of 10 Books on Architecture. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Fredrik Karlsson. 10 Books on Architecture by Vitruvius, translated by Morris Hickey Morgan. Chapter 4. Harmonics. 1. Harmonics is an obscure and difficult branch of musical science, especially for those who do not know Greek. If we decide to treat of it, we must use Greek words, because some of them have no Latin equivalents. Hence, I will explain it as clearly as I can from the writings of Aristoxenus, append his scheme, and define the boundaries of the notes, so that with somewhat careful attention anybody may be able to understand it pretty easily. 2. The voice, in its changes of position when shifting pitch, becomes sometimes high, sometimes low, and its movements are of two kinds, in one of which its progress is continuous, in the other by intervals. The continuous voice does not become stationary at the boundaries or at any definite place, and so the extremities of its progress are not apparent. But the fact that there are differences of pitch is apparent, as in our ordinary speech in sol, lux, flos, vox. For in these cases we cannot tell at what pitch the voice begins, nor at what pitch it leaves off, but the fact that it becomes low from high and high from low is apparent to the ear. In its progress by intervals the opposite is the case, for here, when the pitch shifts, the voice, by change of position, stations itself on one pitch, then on another, and, as it frequently repeats this alternating process, it appears to the senses to become stationary, as happens in singing when we produce a variation of the mode by changing the pitch of the voice. And so, since it moves by intervals, the points at which it begins and where it leaves off are obviously apparent in the boundaries of the notes, but the intermediate points escape notice and are obscure, owing to the intervals. 3. There are three classes of modes. First, that which the Greeks term the enharmonic; second, the chromatic; third, the diatonic. The enharmonic mode is an artistic conception, and therefore execution in it has a specially severe dignity and distinction. The chromatic, with its delicate subtlety and with the crowding of its notes, gives a sweeter kind of pleasure. In the diatonic, the distance between the intervals is easier to understand, because it is natural. These three classes differ in their arrangement of the tetrachord. In the enharmonic, the tetrachord consists of two tones and two dieses. A diesis is a quarter tone, hence in a semitone there are included two dieses. In the chromatic there are two semitones arranged in succession, and the third interval is a tone and a half. In the diatonic there are two consecutive tones, and the third interval of a semitone completes the tetrachord. Hence, in the three classes, the tetrachords are equally composed of two tones and a semitone, but when they are regarded separately according to the terms of each class, they differ in the arrangement of their intervals. 4. Now then, these intervals of tones and semitones of the tetrachord are a division introduced by nature in the case of the voice, and she has defined their limits by measures according to the magnitude of the intervals and determined their characteristics in certain different ways. These natural laws are followed by skilled workmen who fashion musical instruments in bringing them to the perfection of their proper concords. 5. In each class there are 18 notes, termed in Greek phtongoi, of which 8 in all the three classes are constant and fixed, while the other 10, not being tuned to the same pitch, are variable. The fixed notes are those which, being placed between the movable, make up the unity of the tetrachord and remain unaltered in their boundaries according to the different classes. Their names are proslambanomenos, hypate hypaton, hypate meson, mes, netisin hemenon, paramis, nete disogmenon, nete hyperbolion. The movable notes are those which, being arranged in the tetrachord between the immovable, change from place to place according to the different classes. They are called parhypate hyponon, lichenus hypoton, parhypate meson, lichenus meson, trite synhemenon, paranete synhemenon, trite disogmenon, paranete disogmenon, trite hyperbolion, paranete hyperbolion. 6. These notes, from being movable, take on different qualities, for they may stand at different intervals and increasing distances. Thus, parhypate, which in the enharmonic is at the interval at half of a semitone from hypate, has a semitone interval when transferred to the chromatic. What is called lichenus in the enharmonic is at the interval at the semitone from hypate, but when shifted to the chromatic it goes two semitones away, and in the diatonic it is at an interval of three semitones from hypate. Hence, the 10 notes produce three different kinds of modes on account of their changes of position in the classes. 7. There are 5 tetrachords. The first, the lowest, termed in Greek hypaton, second, the middle, called meson, third, the conjunct, termed synemenon, fourth, the disjunct, named disugmenon, the fifth, which is the highest, is termed in Greek hyperbolion. The concords, termed in Greek symphoniae, of which human modulation will naturally admit, are 6 in the number. The fourth, the fifth, the octave and fourth, the octave and fifth, and the double octave. 8. Their names are therefore due to numerical value, for when the voice becomes stationary on some one note, and then, shifting its pitch, changes its position and passes to the limit of the fourth note from that one, we use the term fourth, when it passes to the fifth, the term fifth. 9. For there can be no consonances, either in the case of the notes of stringed instruments or of the singing voice, between two intervals or between 3 or 6 or 7, but, as written above, it is only the harmonies of the fourth, the fifth, and so on up to the double octave that have boundaries naturally corresponding to those of the voice, and these concords are produced by the union of the notes. Chapter 5. Sounding Vessels in the Theatre. 1. In accordance with the foregoing investigations on mathematical principles, let bronze vessels be made proportionate to the size of the theatre, and let them be so fashioned that, when touched, they may be produced with one another the notes of the fourth, the fifth, and so on, up to the double octave. Then, having constructed niches in between the seats of the theatre, let the vessels be arranged in them, in accordance with musical laws, in such a way that they nowhere touch the wall, but have a clear space all round them, and room over their tops. They should be set upside down, and be supported on the side, facing the stage, by wedges not less than half a foot high. Opposite each niche, apertures should be left in the surface of the seat next below, 2 feet long and half a foot deep. 2. The arrangement of these vessels, with reference to the situations of which they should be placed, may be described as follows. If the theatre be of no great size, Mark out a horizontal range halfway up, and in it construct 13 arched niches with 12 equal spaces between them, so that of the above-mentioned echeia, those which give the note nete hyperbolaeon may be placed first on each side in the niches which are at the extreme ends. Next to the ends, and a fourth below in pitch, the note nete disugmenon, third, paramese, a fourth below, fourth, nete synhemenon, fifth, mes, a fourth below, sixth, hypate meson, a fourth below, and in the middle, and another fourth below, one vessel giving the note hypate hypaton. 3. On this principle of arrangement, the voice, uttered from the stage as from a center, and spreading striking against the cavities of the different vessels as it comes in contact with them, will be increased in clearness of sound, and will waken a harmonious note in unison with itself. But if the theatre be rather large, let its height be divided into four parts, so that three horizontal ranges of niches may be marked out and constructed, one for the enharmonic, another for the chromatic, and the third for the diatonic system. Beginning with the bottom range, let the arrangement be as described above in the case of a smaller theatre, but on the enharmonic system. 4. In the middle range, place first at the extreme ends the vessels which give the note of the chromatic hyperbolaeon, next to them those which give the chromatic disugmenon, a fourth below, third the chromatic synhemenon, fourth the chromatic meson, a fourth below, fifth the chromatic hypaton, a fourth below, sixth the paramese, for this is both the concord of the fifth to the chromatic hyperbolaeon and the concord of the chromatic synhemenon. 5. No vessel is to be placed in the middle, for the reason that there is no other note in the chromatic system that forms a natural concord of sound. In the highest division and range of niches, place at the extreme end vessels fashioned so as to give the note of the diatonic hyperbolaeon, next the diatonic disugmenon, a fourth below, third, the diatonic synhemenon, fourth, the diatonic meson, a fourth below, fifth, the diatonic hypaton, a fourth below, sixth, the proslambanomenos, a fourth below, in the middle, the note mes, for this is both the octave to proslambanomenos and the concord of the fifth to diatonic hypaton. 6. Whoever wishes to carry out these principles with ease has only to consult the scheme at the end of this book, drawn up in accordance with the laws of music. It was left by Aristoxenus, who with great ability and labor classified and arranged in it the different modes. In accordance with it, and by giving heed to these theories, one can easily bring a theatre to perfection from the point of view of the nature of the voice, so as to give pleasure to the audience. 7. Somebody will perhaps say that many theatres are built every year in Rome, and that in them no attention at all is paid to these principles. But he will be in error from the fact that all our public theatres made of wood contain a great deal of boarding which must be resonant. This may be observed from the behavior of those who sing to the lyre, who, when they wish to sing in a higher key, turn towards the folding doors on the stage, and thus by their aid are reinforced with the sound in harmony with the voice. But when the theatres are built of solid materials like masonry, stone, or marble, which cannot be resonant, then the principles of the echeia must be applied. 8. If, however, it is asked in what theatre these vessels have been employed, we cannot point to any in Rome itself, but only to those in the districts of Italy and in a good many Greek states. We have also the evidence of Lucius Mummius, who, after destroying the theatre in Corinth, brought its bronze vessels to Rome and made a dedicatory offering at the temple of Luna with the money obtained from the sale of them. Besides, many skilful architects, in constructing theatres in small towns, have, for lack of means, taken large jars made of clay, but similarly resonant, and have produced very advantageous results by arranging them on the principles described. End of Book 5, Chapter 5.
Wow. What's up? I just bought and financed a car through Carvana in minutes.
You? The person who agonized 4 weeks over whether to paint your walls eggshell or off-white bought and financed a car in minutes?
They made it easy. Transparent terms, customizable down and monthly. Didn't even have to do any paperwork.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Hey, have you checked out that spreadsheet I sent you for our dinner options?
Finance your car with Carvana and experience total control. Financing subject to credit approval.
New year, same great savings. All in the Kroger app. Get Kroger Spiral Sliced Ham for 89 cents a pound with your card and an additional $25 purchase limit too. Then get large avocados or mangoes for 99 cents each with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.